Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is how the Pulitzer Prize-winning author John Madison begins his new and gripping biography of Margaret Fuller. She was, in her time, the best-read woman in America and the one most renowned for her intelligence.
As Madison tells us, Fuller was a brilliant writer, a fiery social critic, an ardent feminist before that term had even been invented, and a leading female figure in New England's transcendentalist movement, counting the likes of Emerson, Thoreau, and Poe among her friends.
She edited America's first avant-garde intellectual magazine and was the first foreign correspondent, male or female, for an American newspaper. But in spite of her many achievements, Madison writes, "If the ordinary person knows one thing about Margaret Fuller, it's how her life came to an end."
Hers was a spectacularly tragic death. At the age of 40, she was returning from Europe with her Italian husband and baby boy. The small ship they were on was within sight of Fire Island, New York, when it ran aground. People on the beach watched and did nothing as the waves pushed and battered the boat, which broke apart and sank. Most of the passengers made it ashore, but Margaret Fuller, her husband, and her baby perished.
So why is a woman of such impressive accomplishment and brilliance remembered mostly for the way she died? And why is it worth knowing the full measure of who Margaret Fuller was today? John Madison answers both of those questions and many more in his new biography, The Lives of Margaret Fuller. And John Madison joins us now from the Radio Foundation in New York City. And welcome to Radio Boston, John Madison. It's great to have you.
It is great to be with you, Anthony.
I loved this book. Congratulations. I had such a good time reading it. What a story. It really is something. And let me start with that very first question, which you pose in the prologue. Why is Margaret Fuller, who lived such a thrilling and fascinating life, accomplished so much, moved in such fascinating circles here and in Europe, remembered most for that awful and tragic death?
Well, you know, for one thing, it is such an extraordinary finish and such an incredible tragedy to have lost her so early, so young, when she was on the verge of a new phase in her life. And so, as a biographer, you actually do kind of look for that. You look for the great story arc and the slam bang finish. But I think also over time, I've really become very attracted to the story of Margaret Fuller. And for me, that tragedy does become a little bit personal. I think the other thing, too, is that maybe one of the reasons that her life is not remembered as well is that she spent much of her life trying to make herself into really the greatest person that she could be. And she wasn't really that focused on leaving a legacy. And she certainly didn't have time to think about leaving a legacy. And so the greatest thing that she invented was herself. And, we're all mortal. So that's one of the reasons that I think she's less remembered than she might be.
Interesting. I want to talk more about that awful death, but I want to first talk about her life, because there's so much there. She was born in 1810 in Cambridgeport, not far from our studios.
Yeah.
And even early in life, she was considered very precocious, very intelligent. And her father, a lawyer and later a congressman, decides to educate her at home. Tell us why. What did women of that era face when it came to education?
Well, they faced all kinds of hurdles. When Margaret was born, there was not a single co-educational college in the country. Oberlin College, I think, was founded when she was in her teens out in Ohio. But if a girl was going to get education, it was pretty much going to have to be from some other source. And she went to some schools for young ladies and so forth, and was completely frustrated by that entire experience, because she thought that she was made for better things than learning how to use the right spoon or land a Harvard man or something like that. And so what happened was, her father saw very early on that she was special, that she was really different from, really any child he had ever seen. And so he really kind of undertook a bit of an experiment to see whether a girl, heavens forfend, you know, could be taught ancient, you know, languages, you know, could learn Latin and Greek. And Margaret was incredibly proficient at these skills at a really early age. I mean, by the time she was 9 years old, she was translating Virgil fluently. And, you know, this wasn't unusual for boys necessarily. You know, a lot of her friends went through the same kind of rigorous home education. But she was essentially the only girl of her time that went through that early training. And so, you know, she had to be pretty brilliant to begin with. You know, I don't think you can manufacture a genius. But her father saw that he had something extraordinary, and so he put a lot of effort into cultivating it as much as he could.
And she becomes the first woman who is granted access to the Harvard College Library and eventually finds work as a teacher, right? How important was that work to her?
Well, Margaret really cared a great deal about teaching because everything that she experienced as a young woman and even as a girl was really connected with education. I mean, that was the way that she impressed people. It was the way that she, you know, won the love and affection of her father, was through intellectual means. And so for Margaret, almost every relationship that she was ever in was in some way pedagogical. I mean, she was either learning from someone or teaching someone, you know, not just in a classroom, but just in her day-to-day life. She really felt that the way that you show love for someone is to share what you know and to bring out, you know, the other person's inner, you know, intellectual and emotional nature. And so teaching, you know, you couldn't imagine Margaret Fuller's life without teaching in one way or another.
I came across a quote, and forgive me, I'm not sure if I found this in your book or in some of the other research I was doing from her. A house is no home unless it contains food and fire for the mind as well as the body. I don't know why that just came to mind about what you were talking about, what you were saying about her thirst for intellectual sustenance, I guess.
Yeah, very much. I mean, one of the things that was, you know, kind of unfortunate about her upbringing was that although it was a very intellectually rich one, it was a very sort of physically and emotionally restricted and limited one. And so she really learned to relate to the world through her mind. And as time went by, I mean, she came to realize that you can't really live life just as a brain. You need to balance things out and you need to, you know, relate to people on the basis of the heart as well as the head. But for her, it was a kind of a self-teaching. I mean, a lot of us, you know, learn our emotional responses when we're very young. And she really had to kind of go back and learn herself and to teach herself, you know, how does one, you know, actually interact on some other level? But you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, intellectual inquiry was just totally indispensable to her.
Mm. Now, she gets to know people like Emerson and Thoreau, and she becomes a leading female figure in the Transcendentalist movement. And you write that she found the male Transcendentalists attractive because, and I'm going to quote you here, they were among the few important thinkers of the moment who were willing to see past the facade of gender. So that was hugely important to her, right?
Yeah, very definitely. Margaret, I think she felt imprisoned in her body in more ways than one. She experienced really bad migraine headaches from a very early age. She was nearsighted. She had spinal curvature. And so her physical existence was not really kind of a happy place for her. And so, you know, she obviously compensated for that, you know, through her mental activity. But she really kind of yearned for a situation in which the things that people cared about where you were concerned were the things that you had in your head and the things that you had in your heart. And, you know, if you know much about Transcendentalism, you know that physical reality was very secondary to them. What they really cared about was what you thought and what you felt. And because of that, they were much more able than most of the other, you know, even the intellectuals of the time, to see past gender and to see a person just as a mind and as a soul. And for Margaret, that was really very liberating. And it's one of the reasons she was so deeply attracted to people like Thoreau and Emerson.
I'm here with John Madison. He's the author of The Lives of Margaret Fuller. I'm interested how her male colleagues, her fellow Transcendentalists, folks like Emerson and Thoreau, received her. How did they view her?
Well, at the beginning, they viewed her as a real curiosity. Margaret, for several years, wanted to meet Ralph Waldo Emerson, and they kept somehow missing each other. And then finally, when she did meet him, it was really at a crossroads in her life. It was shortly after her father, who had been so influential, had very suddenly died. And she was looking, at least on some sort of unconscious level, for someone to fill that void. So she, finally gets an invitation to go and visit Emerson and his new wife and to stay with them in Concord for a couple of weeks. And when she first gets there, Emerson just looks at her and thinks to himself, well, who are you? And actually wrote later that, when she first opened her mouth, I thought that we would never get on because she was kind of, she was off-putting in some ways.
Off-putting because she was so damn smart and she wanted you to know it, right?
Yeah, because she was so damn smart because she didn't really observe a lot of the polite conventions of conversation. She really wanted to cut right to the meat of everything. She wanted to, she did not BS. Really, she wanted a very close, very fast relationship, emotionally, intellectually, not physically, with just about everybody that she met. And so Emerson was kind of back on his heels, right? Because he was, very used to sort of the, New England reserve and a little bit of distance. And she just wiped that distance out. She cut it down with a chainsaw. And so he was used to just sort of sitting back with a half bemused smile, and she had him laughing. Huh. And that was actually kind of uncomfortable for him because it was not the way that he usually wanted to present himself. But the fact of the matter is she came to stay for 2 weeks and she ended up staying for three because in the end he couldn't get enough of her.
I want to just, for folks who don't know a lot about her, I want to say this really quickly. She becomes the first editor of The Dial, which is an important transcendentalist quarterly. Based on her journal, she publishes Then she publishes a book, Women in the 19th Century, right? Which is considered Women in the 19th Century, which is really one of the earliest feminist texts. Can you tell us a little bit about that and the impact that that had?
Yeah, it was really groundbreaking because it was 3 years before the Seneca Falls Convention, which everyone thinks of as the kickoff for American feminism. But Fuller was out ahead of the pack. And the thing that she most cared about, once again, was to be accepted as an intellectual equal. But as time had gone by, she had realized that just that kind of acceptance wasn't enough, and it didn't really mean anything unless women had economic rights, unless they had political rights, because as long as they were placed in a subordinate social position, they were going to be kept down in the fields that she really cared most about, the intellectual and so forth. So Woman in the 19th Century starts off by illustrating all of the incredible women in history, showing that women are not subordinate. They're not inferior. They've only been, put that way. And also illustrating very, very powerfully that as long as half of a society is being kept down, the entire society is being kept down. That men are never going to be as great as they would like to be unless they make room for the rest of the species.
Fascinating. Yeah. I mean, and fascinating, especially when you think about the point in history where she was presenting these views, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, nobody really understood what she was getting at, I don't think. Woman in the 19th Century comes out the same year that Frederick Douglass publishes his first narrative. And they're trying to do the same thing, really. They're trying to gain acceptance for their groups, Douglass for African Americans,
sure,
and Margaret for female Americans. And Douglass succeeds in a way that she doesn't. He's able to construct himself, to present himself as the black everyman that everybody's going to side with and really care about. Whereas Margaret is using Woman in the 19th Century in part just as a way of illustrating that a woman can write a really complicated, very sophisticated book. And Edgar Allan Poe picks it up and he reads and he says, well, this is fine, but there are really only two women in the world who could have written it. So and only two women who could benefit from the kind of freedom that she's asking for. So we really don't have to pay much attention to it.
Huh,
so she was very eager to gain for women everything that she could, but it was a tremendous hill for her to try to climb.
In the time that we have left, I really want to talk about her life in Europe and her adventure and marriage in Italy. But first, let's take a call or two because we've got some listeners on the line. I'm talking to John Madison. He's the Pulitzer Prize winning author of a new biography about Margaret Fuller. It's called The Lives of Margaret Fuller. Let's go to Brenda, who's calling from Framingham. Hi, Brenda.
Hi, I'm delighted to hear this discussion. About a few years back, I read a book by Sana Jenner Nesland called Ahab's Wife. And in the story, the main character, Ahab's wife, whose name escapes me now, somehow finds her way through a bunch of different episodes that she goes on. She finds her way in Boston. This is a historical fiction where mm-hmm. she's taken under wing by Margaret Fuller. And she's that's the first time I had ever heard of Margaret Fuller. I've known about the, you know, major players in transcendentalism, but hearing this now, and you know, and in the story, it talks something about how she educates Ahab's wife to be more of a feminist, to stand up on her own and do the things that she needs to do in the difficulties that she's had through her life that brings her to Margaret Fuller. So she becomes sort of like her protege, if you will. Now I'm hearing this, and I'm so delighted. I want to read this book.
Read it. I recommend it.
The real Margaret Fuller.
Absolutely, Brenda. It's worth reading, and thanks for the call. Let's go to Paul, who's calling from Springfield. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Now, I have Margaret Fuller's desk here at the house.
How about that? Are you related to her?
Yeah. She was my great-great-grandfather's sister. My great-great-grandfather was Arthur Buckminster Fuller.
Oh, my goodness. So you're a cousin of Bucky Fuller.
Yeah, my grandmother was a cousin of Bucky, yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
My grandmother is, I think, most influenced by Margaret Fuller, as she was the first woman to graduate from MIT with an advanced degree in architecture.
And
became quite a well-known architect for a woman, especially in her age, you know. So...
Well, Paul, thank you so much for bringing that connection to the program. We appreciate it. That's Paul there from Springfield, a great nephew of Margaret Fuller. John Madison, let me ask you about her time in Italy, which is such a fascinating chapter in her life. She dreams all of her life of going to Europe. She finally gets a chance to go there. And in part, she's reporting for Horace Greeley and the New York Tribune around this initial failed effort at Italian independence. But what draws her there? What is it about Europe that creates this, exerts this enormous pull on her?
Yeah, I think, you know, to a certain extent, she was frustrated with America. She had felt that she had exhausted all of the resources, the intellectual resources of New England. She'd kind of been there and done that. She thought for a while that New York was going to satisfy her. She was always looking for that place that was going to reflect back to her all of the many facets of her personality in which she could, you know, live in the all and to be the sort of the grandest self and the most fulfilled self that she could possibly be. And even from the time that she was little, she wanted to go to Europe, and she, you know, opportunities passed her by, and it was, you know, always felt very tragic that she wasn't able to go. And so finally, through the New York Tribune, she was able to go to Europe. She goes through England, down through France, and finally to Italy. And she says that she's really found her true home. You know, she finds it in terms of the art. She finds it in terms of the Italian people, who she said, because they were struggling for freedom and did not already, you know, have it, they didn't take for granted the things that Americans took for granted. And interestingly enough, it was only after she got to Italy and saw people fighting for democracy there that she got a clue as to the American abolitionists. You know, previously she had thought, oh, you know, these anti-slavery people, they're kind of tedious and they demand too much and so on and so forth. And then she gets to Italy and the light comes on and she begins to understand this whole different dimension of political and personal freedom. You know, we think of America as the land of the free. Obviously, in many ways it was and is. And yet she just found a grandeur in her surroundings, particularly in Rome, that she'd never seen any place else, and she really felt that she had finally found her home.
And of course, she falls in love with a young Marquis, Giovanni Ossoli, 11 years younger than her. They have a baby. Yep. And mm-hmm. because of the time, she actually conceals the relationship, the marriage, yep. and the baby. Why mm-hmm. did she feel she had to do that? Just because of social mores of the time?
Oh, well, there are a whole lot of reasons. I mean, for one thing, her husband was hoping to inherit the family fortune. He was of noble birth, but the family was a bit down at the heels. But he was really hoping to, you know, get some of the estate when his parents passed on. And if they had, you know, found out that he, you know, had a child with a Protestant American, that pretty much would have, you know, finished that notion. And so there was that practical notion, you know, aspect to it. But also, you know, I think, or I hope I've been putting across, that Fuller really wanted to perfect herself.
Mm-hmm.
And when she falls in love with Ossoli, when she, you know, lets down her guard, when she, you know, welcomes him into her bedroom and you know, emerges pregnant, she really has to deal with the fact that she feels she's let herself down horribly. But at the same time, she's entered into this new phase of life whereby she really can't think about herself first. She has to think about her child. She has to think about Ossoli. And so, you know, initially, when she finds out that she's pregnant, she's horribly ashamed, and she drops little cryptic hints into her newspaper columns, hinting that she might even commit suicide. But then she comes to terms with it, and although she can't really be honest about it, you know, initially, she sort of has to tell her friends, you know, one by one and in very sort of careful ways. But it's the experience through which, in some ways, she becomes fully human. She has always wanted to connect with the world, never expecting to do it through a husband and a child. And voila, there it is.
There it is. And of course, yeah. They make the decision finally that the Italian independence movement at that moment goes badly. Eventually, yeah. They flee from Rome to Florence and end up deciding to head back to America to begin this new life together, which yeah. brings us back to this devastating and tragic shipwreck where right. she dies. Yeah. It's a beautifully written story about a remarkable woman. And our time is up, sadly, John Madison. I'd love to talk more about it, but thank you so much for coming in and talking about this remarkable woman, Margaret Fuller.
The pleasure's absolutely been mine. Be well.
That's John Madison. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. His new biography is called The Lives of Margaret Fuller. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at boston.com.
Our show is produced by Jessica Alpert, Amory Sievertson, and Dina Rosendorf. We're receiving production help this week from Aisha Siddiqui.
Tim Skog is our technical director.
The executive producer of Radio Boston is Mark Navin.
I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We here at Radio Boston wish you all the peace and happiness of this season. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.